From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! U.S. troops fire on a crowd of civilians in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul yesterday, killing at least 10 people and injuring scores. Meanwhile, residents of Baghdad are dying from unexploded U.S. cluster bombs. We'll talk to Christian Science Monitor reporter Scott Peterson in Baghdad. And we'll hear a speech from former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney on the true costs of war.
When you add up the corruption cost, the moral cost, the human cost, they far outweigh the dollar cost, and the dollar costs are astronomical.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops fired on a crowd of civilians in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul yesterday, killing at least 10 people and injuring many others. Witnesses told the Agence France-Presse the newly appointed governor of Mosul, Mahran al-Jabouri, made a pro-American speech at City Hall. The crowd became increasingly hostile and U.S. troops opened fire. A U.S. military spokesperson denied the charges, claiming U.S. troops were shot at from at least two gunmen on a rooftop and they fired back towards the rooftop. But witnesses said children began throwing stones and the U.S. soldiers started firing into the crowd when they saw people running at the government building. Again, the death toll, at least 10, those injured more than 100. This comes as the U.S. held the first talks in Iraq on a post-invasion national government. The meeting was held at the Tal el Air base outside of Nasiriyah. The U.S. said dozens of representatives from Iraq's ethnic, tribal, and exiled opposition groups were included, but they refused to release the names. Armed U.S. Marines stood behind barbed wire and blocked access to Iraqis who wanted to attend but were not invited by the United States. One Iraqi, Zamil Hamid, told the London Guardian, quote, "I tried to participate, but they would not allow me to. One of the U.S. soldiers told me I was not on the list." The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the main Shiite Muslim group there, boycotted the talks and thousands protested outside. The Washington Post reports that protesters shouted no to occupation. They denounced the gathering as illegitimate and unrepresentative of long-established Iraqi opposition groups. They said key Shiite groups and their leaders were not included in the meeting. The Guardian of London also reports protesters called for rule by their ayatollahs, not freedom as conceived by Westerners. Inside, the Guardian reports many of the speeches were met with lukewarm applause and the most vital questions for the future remained unanswered. A statement at the end of the meeting set out 13 principles for a new Iraqi government, including democracy, federalism, nonviolence, respect for diversity, including a role for women. It was unclear who'd suggested the points and whether the Iraqis had voted on any issue other than a decision to meet again in 10 days. For those outside, the Washington Post reports the meeting was upstaged by the arrival in Nasiriyah of Sheikh Mohammed Bakr Nasri. The 71-year-old Nasri is a leader of the long-outlawed Dawah Party, a Shiite organization dedicated to forming an Islamic Republic in Iraq. He returned Monday after fleeing a death sentence in 1979. At the Al Bayt Mosque was greeted with cheers, poems, and tears by a crowd of more than 2,000 people. He delivered a fiery political speech calling on U.S. troops to make way for an Iraqi government within 6 months. U.S. forces captured Palestinian guerrilla leader Abu Abbas in Baghdad yesterday, Abbas masterminded the hijacking of the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro in 1985. One American was killed in that hijacking. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat is demanding his release. Erekat said that a 1995 agreement between Israel and Palestine, and signed by the U.S., states that members of the Palestine Liberation Organization must not be detained or tried for activities that occurred before the Oslo Peace Accord of 1993. Abu Abbas said he was abandoning terrorism after the Oslo Accords, and in 1998, the Israeli Supreme Court declared him immune from prosecution in Israel over the ship's hijacking. An Israeli Security Committee concluded he had renounced violence and allowed him to return to the Gaza Strip. Despite all this, Pentagon spokesperson Captain Frank Thorpe jumped on the capture of Abbas, calling it proof of a link between Saddam Hussein and terrorism. Reuters reports he also said it helped to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, the suspected chemical and biological laboratories found in trailers buried near Karbala are not smoking guns after all. U.S. nuclear experts said some radioactive material was discovered there, but was most likely used for civilian purposes. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Tuesday U.S. forces are cutting off an oil pipeline that has been delivering oil from Iraq to Syria. The pipeline is capable of delivering 200,000 barrels of oil per day and is a huge source of revenue for Syria. Meanwhile, U.S. officials continued their accusations against Syria, claiming they believe former Iraqi spy chief Farouk Hijazi is one of several top-ranking Iraqis hiding there. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said yesterday there's no war plan, quote, right now. Meanwhile, Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharra said the Australian government-owned special broadcasting service, he told it, that Syria is willing to sign a treaty making the entire Middle East a zone free of weapons of mass destruction. But the Islamic Republic news agency is citing the German Daily Bild as reporting the U.S. has begun a major military buildup along the Iraqi-Syrian border. The German paper is reporting new U.S. troop contingents armed with tanks, fighter planes, and helicopters have been secretly deployed in the Iraqi town of Ar-Rutba. A second Argentine journalist has died from injuries suffered in a car crash near Baghdad. Veronica Cabrera was 28 years old. She worked for the Argentine channel America TV. Now 13 journalists have been killed in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. The Guardian is reporting tens of thousands of Iraqis have lost all of their savings as a result of looting, which has left the country without a single functioning bank. Many government offices were stripped by ordinary people, but Baghdad's banks were looted by professional gangs. Millions more face the prospect of poverty in the absence of a government which can resume paying the salaries of teachers, doctors, civil servants, and factory workers. Meanwhile, the American dollar is taking over in Iraqi cities. The Saddam dinar is fetching as much as $80 on the internet auction site eBay. And U.S. investigators are scrambling to track down Saddam Hussein's fortune. Middle Eastern banking sources told The Guardian as Baghdad fell, Iraqi bank accounts were ransacked and millions of dollars were transferred into private accounts abroad, going mainly through Europe to accounts in Jordanian and Palestinian banks. The missing money is estimated at between $5 and $40 billion. The 12-year-old Iraqi boy named Ali Ismail Abbas, who became a symbol of civilian suffering in Iraq after he lost his arms in a U.S. bombing raid, has been flown to Kuwait. There, he will undergo operations and will hopefully emerge with prosthetic arms. But he leaves behind scores of wounded Iraqis at the mercy of the country's collapsing healthcare system. While U.S. Marines and tanks continue to guard the oil ministry, hospital staff are forced to fend for themselves. The BBC reports only 4 of Baghdad's 30 hospitals are still operating. And the Center on Conscience and War reports that at least several hundred U.S. soldiers have applied for conscientious objector status since January, when the prospect of war in Iraq seemed imminent. A specially modified coalition plane called Commando Solo is flying over Iraq, broadcasting both television and radio several hours a day. The new network is called Towards Freedom. But with power cut in most of Baghdad, only people who have power generators can tune in, and the signal is weak. The new channel's broadcast included a commentary in which the presenter attacks Saddam Hussein, calling him uneducated and saying he'd seized power by force and had executed his own people. A news program called Iraq and the World claimed life in Baghdad is slowly getting back to normal as some shops are opening. British officials have said the content for the new service has been agreed in discussions with Iraqi exiles. Production of the British content has been outsourced to a private London-based company called World Television. Its producers and journalists are all Arabs. The Pentagon is also producing content, including slides of propaganda leaflets. A Bush administration official is heading to Beijing next week for talks with North Korea. The breakthrough came after North Korea dropped its insistence on one-on-one talks with the U.S. China will play host and participate in the negotiations. The U.S. and North Korea have not held official talks since Pyongyang restarted its nuclear program and expelled international inspectors. And the president of South Africa pledged today to pay reparations totaling $85 million to more than 19,000 victims of apartheid crimes. President Thabo Mbeki announced that the family of each victim will receive a one-time payment of close to $4,000. Mbeki also announced he would not issue a general amnesty for perpetrators of past abuses. Stop the War Now, the late Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. The opening lines of a piece in today's Christian Science Monitor, co-authored by Scott Peterson in Baghdad, is it's called Baghdad's Unexploded Bombs. It begins, a 2-inch long black cylinder hangs on a white stabilizer ribbon from the branch of a lemon tree, a deadly fruit in a leafy Baghdad neighborhood. It's one of the unexploded cluster bombs fired by U.S. forces last week that still litter several residential areas of the city. On this street alone, residents say the controversial bomblets have killed 4 men. About 100 unexploded cylinders lie under bushes and in the gutters of houses in the district of Al-Kamarnik, according to U.S. bomb disposal experts who were encasing them in plaster Tuesday or blowing them up. Scott Peterson joins us on the line now from Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott.
Thank you.
Can you talk more about these cluster bombs, these unexploded ordnance?
Well, what was remarkable was that these cluster bombs were used against targets in the city itself, in Baghdad, in residential areas. So, of course, it's the kind of thing. I mean, we've seen it not just in Iraq, but we saw it in Kosovo, and we've seen it in other previous conflicts. And of course, they create all kinds of problems for residents, because they sit there unexploded. Many of them don't explode upon impact, or as we saw yesterday, they're hanging in lemon trees and other places waiting to explode. What we did see yesterday, however, were that American forces had begun to collect those cluster bombs so that they would no longer be able to kill or maim anybody. And I also saw in several different locations in the city where where American forces were collecting different kinds of ordnance, rockets, artillery shells, grenades, ammunition, and taking them to a collection point not far from the airport. So trying to get that kind of material out of the city.
What are people saying about them in the neighborhood, and who were the men who died?
Well, the situation in these neighborhoods is such that the material is around. There are certainly not enough American troops to police all of Baghdad. This is a city of 5 million people, and there really are a huge number of facilities. Looting is continuing in various places, and basically, even though the Iraqi police have begun to come back onto the streets, in some cases patrolling alongside American troops, there still is a large degree of lawlessness, and certainly the U.S. forces are trying to get a grip on that, and to some degree the looting has burned itself out, in the sense that there isn't much left to loot. All the ministries have been burned out except for the oil ministry, which has been protected from very early on by American forces. And so really it seems that the rebuilding process is going to have to just about start from scratch in a lot of these cases.
You talk about the Geneva Convention in your piece in the Christian Science Monitor, Scott. Can you talk about cluster bombs and the Geneva Convention?
Well, the issue with cluster bombs is a question of an indiscriminate weapon. And a cluster bomb certainly, most weapons, if they're targeted, are aimed at a specific military target. And in this case, there didn't seem to be any target within a kilometer, except for a couple of anti-aircraft weapons that could have conceivably been the target of a cluster bomb. But for the type of weaponry that the United States has, or what it can use to target those kind of anti-aircraft guns, it seems that a cluster bomb is not precisely the right type of weapon for it, considering the casualties that can result civilian more often than not when it comes to cluster bombs, and also considering the controversial nature of this weapon. One would have thought that the United States would err on the side of not using it if it had a different type of munition to be used on a target.
Do you know what company makes cluster bombs in the United States?
No, I'm not. I'm sure that there are several manufacturers of those bombs in the U.S., and they have been controversial throughout. I mean, American military spokesmen will simply say that they use the appropriate munition for the kind of target that they are presented with. Although, of course, we know full well that that those targets or those rounds can go astray, and mistakes can be made, and it's one of the things that makes war an ugly business, no matter how technically advanced a military force is.
Scott, earlier in the week, you wrote about the frustration in Baghdad rising and the new, quote, mayor of Baghdad.
Well, that's right. I mean, the frustration has been really with the looting and the fact that people, I mean, though they are happy that Saddam Hussein has left, has been toppled, what they are not happy about has been this new degree of lawlessness, this uncertainty, and also, of course, there have been several incidents that have shown that the United States forces are not necessarily as benevolent as they might appear. I mean, there have been several sniping and other incidents where civilians have been killed at checkpoints. There have been other incidents, one that I was reporting on earlier today, in which several houses were destroyed when a Bradley fighting vehicle shot up Iraqi trucks that were loaded up with ammunition and caused a blast far larger than either the Americans or Iraqis expected. So those kind of things are still happening, but nevertheless, at the same time, you've also got American, units who are going out and trying to bring Iraqi electricians, water experts, and other people who understand those systems and trying to bring those back online and make them work as well. So, I mean, it's progress in some cases and steps backward in others.
You write about Mohammed Messin of the Iraqi National Congress and Brigadier Zuhair Anouami, one of Hussein's top police officers.
Right. Well, these are, I mean, these are people who are positing themselves, you know, to come back and play a lead role here. And I think that they haven't yet defined what line, I mean, the United States military, which will be making most of these decisions, despite all the talk of democracy, will be, you know, they're trying to determine what line to draw between former regime apparatchiks and how close they were or not to the Ba'ath Party, and where they draw the line on who is now acceptable in any new government and who isn't.
I know you're on deadline, so I won't keep you, but in the past, we've interviewed you on your series of pieces that you did on depleted uranium and the U.S. military use of it from Iraq during the Persian Gulf War to Kosovo. Have you done any research on that now in the current U.S. invasion?
Well, there's no question that depleted uranium has been used in Iraq, just as it has been in those previous conflicts, and I think it's been used quite extensively here. Almost all of the tanks that we see on the streets of Baghdad that have been shot up by American forces, and indeed those that that faced off with the U.S. just south of Baghdad around Al-Quds and other places, seem to have their turrets blown off, and for those that were shown to have been burning immediately after they were hit, they show the kind of fire and evidence of depleted uranium being used on those tanks. So, I mean, we've seen that. We know it's been widely used, and we've also even seen A-10 aircraft, which use primarily depleted uranium rounds, firing those at the Ministry of Planning here. And there really is all kinds of evidence on that. But yes, this is definitely something to be pursued.
You also have written about the Fayyadeen, and you got a chance to interview one.
Right, the Fedayeen. Well, what's remarkable, I'll leave you on this, what's remarkable about the Fedayeen that I interviewed was that his orders were not to engage in the defense of Baghdad or not to disrupt or cause trouble even before the war began, but that his orders were to wait and wait and wait until after American forces were already here, after the regime fell, and then to cause trouble, as if the cynicism of the regime of Saddam Hussein was meant to kind of be one of its lasting legacies, that they would that these forces would try to make ruling Baghdad almost impossible and to disrupt American forces even after the regime had gone.
Are you staying at the Palestine Hotel, Scott?
Yes, that's right.
And what is the scene like there right now? We read yesterday about the U.S. Marines raiding the hotel and moving into the rooms of journalists.
Right, I'll leave you on this one. But the thing that is remarkable about Baghdad now is that you can go just about everywhere, just about anywhere, and learn. See, all you know is what really is right in front of your face and what you witness. I spent a large portion of the day yesterday in the Palestine and other times out on the street. We saw looting. We saw other things out on the street. I mean, in terms of what happened at the Palestine, some people have been talking about Marines going from room to room, finding in search of former officials and others, and in other cases, you know, we haven't heard about that. Did I see it myself? I didn't in this case, but I certainly heard that some people had seen that.
We also heard that a 13th journalist has died, Veronica Cabrera, who is an Argentine journalist with Argentine Channel America TV.
Right, right. The streets are certainly still dangerous, and, you know, we still wear our bulletproof vests, and we're still traveling around very, very cautiously.
Finally, are you unembedded?
I am unembedded, indeed.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. Scott Peterson, reporting to us from Baghdad, an unembedded reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. You are listening to Democracy Now! Be safe, Scott. We'll be back in a minute with Congressmember Cynthia McKinney. Diabolati by Dalida here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The London Observer reported this weekend that the U.S. multinational corporation DynCorp has won a multi-million dollar contract to police Iraq. DynCorp began recruiting for a private police force last week. But the corporation faces accusations of human rights violations around the world. A British tribunal recently forced DynCorp to pay compensation to an employee who blew the whistle on colleagues involved in a sex ring in Bosnia, where the company was policing. Ecuadorians have filed a class action lawsuit against the company for spraying herbicides that killed legitimate crops, caused illness, and killed children. Former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney spoke last week about DynCorp, as well as a number of costs of war. She was speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at an event sponsored by Peace Action.
Today, I read in the Atlanta newspaper, mainstream newspaper, we call it the urinal and constipation, that a young woman from Georgia is breastfeeding her child, and so she has said that she will not take the shots, the anthrax vaccine, or any other shots that they force her to take. For that courageous stand, she has been stripped of her promotion and punished and put in jail. So now I'm going to find the parents of this young girl and commend them for raising a woman of such courage. But these instances of courage we need to know about and protect those people, those young people, because they will surely be punished and ostracized. But what is the record of those people who took those shots and who took those vaccines? Well, the record is not a very good one. And so then we, you know, we have to start asking ourselves, well, now exactly who are these companies that have the contracts to administer these vaccines to the public anyway, starting with the military first? And why was it so important for them to be shielded from lawsuits that may result from their something going wrong with their scientific formula? Well, I won't answer the question, but I hope there's some bright young people here who will answer that question and let us all know. And don't be surprised if one of the companies, well, I guess maybe I'll give half of an answer. If one of the companies happens to be a company like DynCorp that was recently shown to be dealing in sex slavery in Bosnia. But what does DynCorp have as it sits on that road between the Capitol Hill and Dulles Airport? What does DynCorp have? Probably very powerful people on the inside who are able to get these contracts, notwithstanding that they have criminals among them who break the law. So one of the other costs of action that I see, not just the human cost, but there's also the corruption cost. And we are beginning to see more and more that there's a whole lot of corruption. Now, how much corruption can we sustain before the American people will say no? That's my question. I'm already outraged. You go on Transparency International, and well, we ought to be number one. Because, you know, we are number one in military weapons, and we are number one in the economy, and we are number one in so many things, right? Well, yeah, I know. You would think we ought to be number one in honesty, too, but we're not. And so then we shouldn't be surprised if we read a headline from The Guardian, and most of the headlines are from Australia and Britain or whatever, you know. We rarely get these kinds of headlines here, but that Dick Cheney is still on the Halliburton payroll. Now, how in the world can we have a vice president who gets paid? I don't know how much he gets paid, but that's the public money. He's our public servant, and yet he's still serving Halliburton. So we shouldn't be surprised if Halliburton gets all these contracts for post-war Iraq, or if Halliburton gets contracts for Guantanamo Bay, or if Halliburton gets contracts to feed the troops. So how come they ain't got no food? How come we're reading that the troops over there don't have enough food and the Iraqi refugees are feeding them? Anyway, we read that from The Guardian that Dick Cheney gets up to $1 million a year. Can you imagine? Richard Pearl! Let me just remind you on Dick Cheney, he got 5 deferments. 5 deferments! Chicken hop. Richard Pearl, so the courageous journalist at New Yorker tells us, formed a company after September 11th, Trireme Partners is the name of the company, and it's all about homeland security. And he's over there trying to meet and make appointments with who? I mean, these arms dealers that we all look down on, dealers of death and destruction, and the chairman of the Defense Policy Board is over there trying to make money off of, you know, these guys? It's unbelievable. But Richard Pearl thought he could do that. And he did do that, if we are to believe Seymour Hersh. And Global Crossing seems like all these corporations, you know, they were just like troughs for the rich and powerful. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican, right? If you want to feed at the trough, then you feed from Enron or Global Crossing, and you could be Bill Clinton, you could be Terry McAuliffe, you could be Richard Pearl. What's the difference, right? I know. So we've got Richard Pearl. How can the nominee for Treasury Secretary sell a portion of his company to the Carlyle Group and nobody say anything? I'm just sitting up here scratching my head. Okay, was that perhaps, you know, is there like, you know, is that what it took in order for you to get the nomination? And so now the Carlyle Group has CSX ships. And the Alaska Journal of Commerce, see, that's why the internet is such a wonderful thing, tells us that they sold all of their ships for $300 million to the Carlyle Group, which brings me to the Carlyle Group. Now, how can the president's daddy be on the payroll for a company that does business and has as its partners the people they say are our enemies? I mean, how can that happen, and how can nobody say anything? It's beyond me. And so now we've got Clayman from Judicial Watch, who says, Daddy Bush, you need to resign from the Carlyle Group. And so, you know, that's a wonderful thing because Clayman is like on their side. So that's an insider saying, you know, that's not good. But for the rest of us, it ain't good either. And, you know, I'm sitting in the House Armed Services Committee, a seat that was a very privileged seat to have because it was Ron Dellums and Pat Schroeder who gave me the seat that they had to share for 1 year. Because when Ron Dellums and Pat Schroeder asked to serve on the Armed Services Committee, there was a Southern boll weevil who was chairman who didn't think that women and black people had any business making U.S. military policy. And so he just made them share a seat. They literally shared one seat for a whole year. And when Pat Schroeder decided to leave the Congress, she came down to Georgia and passed the torch to me. And Ron Dellums fought hard for me to get that position on the Armed Services Committee. So Donald Rumsfeld comes to the committee one day and he's presenting the budget. And it just so happens that they've asked for money in the budget for the Crusader missile, which everybody said, you know, we don't want, but it was in the president's budget. And Rumsfeld says, oh yeah, and by the way, even though the Pentagon has lost $2.3 trillion, America can afford the $48 billion increase that we're asking for, and so therefore you ought to give it to us, members of Congress. And so no one said anything, and I'm just saying to myself, now how can the Secretary of Defense come to the House Armed Services Committee and say to us in one, like almost in one sentence, yeah, we lost the $2.3 trillion that some people say we lost, GAO, meaning some people, GAO, $2.3 trillion that we lost. We are going to change U.S. military policy so that we can seize foreign capitals and occupy them. That's what he said in the committee, and nobody asked questions. And I'm saying to myself, when was this decided by the American people? This is a radical departure from what we have known. And so I dissented and wrote a dissent and included my criticism of the request for the Crusader missile, which was going to go to United Defense, which is a subsidiary of Carlyle Group, and how inappropriate it was. And all of a sudden, all the water came out of the dam. And then, like, you know, how can you read in, like, The Observer talking about bin Laden and noting that, you know, the bin Laden family was dealing with the Carlyle Group, you read that MI6 stopped a bid to arrest bin Laden when he could have been arrested. Now, why would the intelligence agencies stop arresting someone who's, you know, an outlaw? Why would they stop that? And then it came out, of course, after I went through all of my little problem, that the FBI had an informant living with the hijackers. Living! Now how can the FBI have informants living with the hijackers and they not know what's going on? And they try and tell us and heads don't roll, because if you and I are late on our job for 1 week straight, we get fired. How can you allow something like this to happen? Four planes hijacked. Simultaneously, our own Pentagon, which is poised to project its defense capability around the world, and it can't even protect itself in Washington, D.C. And heads don't roll. And then, well, CNN did come through one time. They posted on their internet site, CNN.com, the headline, Bush asks Daschle to limit September 11th probes. And I couldn't believe it. Why is Bush asking Tom Daschle not to investigate September 11th? And then further down in the story, it says, and even further, in a rare call to Tom Daschle, the vice president also asked Tom Daschle not to investigate September 11th. What's going on with that? And then in the Sydney Morning Herald, Sydney as in Australia, because they break a lot of good stories, the Australian newspapers do, the headline just rocked my world. FBI chief so lax, agents felt they were spies. That's the headline. It's still there. You go to the Sydney Morning Herald website for May 28, 2002, and you get the headline. FBI chief so lax, agents felt they were spies. Now, if we don't get an investigation out of them kind of headlines, then what is it that will move the American people? The corruption costs. When people who are rich and powerful and they feel that they don't have to be held accountable for their actions, or governmental officials, they will do a little thing, and if they're not held accountable on the little thing, then they'll do a big thing. How is it that James Bamford can write in Body of Secrets about Operation Northwoods, and there not be an outcry on page? And of course, I invited him immediately so I could hear it straight from the horse's mouth, and I heard it straight from the horse's mouth. But on page 82 of his book, Body of Secrets, he writes about Operation Northwoods, which was a plan that was written and had the approval of the chairman and every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit. Planes would be hijacked using phony evidence. All of it would be blamed on Castro, thus giving an excuse as well as the public and international backing they needed to launch their war. James Bamford, Body of Secrets. He wrote it. He found the documents, and they haven't denied it. Corruption costs. We let them get away with too much. There are the moral costs of what we're doing. Moral costs like this headline from the Associated Press. Allies earmark $40 billion for war relief. But guess where it's coming from? The Iraqis. It's coming from the Iraqi people. So can you imagine? I can't even imagine what a town would look like after a tank has rumbled through its streets and shot up everything. But that's what's happening now. That's exactly what's happening. I've seen burned out, bombed out places on the African continent. And I visited Srebrenica, and I saw what happened there in a city. But can you imagine? I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that we're talking about the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers in the same breath as we're talking about tanks. It's the cradle of who we are, what we are, and we're destroying it.
Former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're going to come back to her speech. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back with former Congressmember McKinney in a minute.
Well, there's a trouble here and trouble everywhere. Say there's trouble here, trouble everywhere. Lord, I would go home, but there's trouble over there. I was born in Louisiana, traveled to Savannah, stopped in Havana, rode to Texarkana. Everywhere I go, seem like trouble is there. Lord, everywhere I go, seem like trouble is over.
Trouble everywhere. Odetta, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to a speech recently given by former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney.
The moral costs of our inconsistency on human rights, and we allow these people to get away with it. You think that the people in Africa are fighting each other just because they like to fight each other? François Mitterrand said, you know, those Africans, they just like to kill each other. His son is in jail now for selling him the guns. So we can do crazy things on the African continent because we don't pay attention and there's no one being held accountable, like demanding that one of the persons who is responsible for the murder of Laurent Kabila in Democratic Republic of Congo actually serve in the cabinet. Or Fode Sanko in Sierra Leone. Madeleine Albright tried to walk away from it, but it was Madeleine Albright's policy that tried to put Fode Sanko, a chopper of the arms and limbs of little boys and rapist of little girls, leader of the Revolutionary United Front, the RUF, put them in charge of diamond mining in Sierra Leone. It was our policy that sought to do that. And thank goodness the Sierra Leoneans fought back. Sierra Leoneans here and around the world fought back. And that didn't happen. But can you imagine we've got an administration that proposes a tax cut? I understand that New Mexico is fighting the big companies that come in, the big shopping companies that come in, and you want to try to hold on to your mom and pop character. Well, just imagine that the five Walton siblings will get more from Bush's tax cut than the 1 million employees that are employed by Walmart. Can you imagine? They get away with it because we let them. The gap between the rich and the poor is increasing in America, and the corruption costs, like MKUltra. Just read about Operation Northwoods, Operation Lantern Spike, MKUltra, Amy Goodman's show. You can still go on her website and find out about Paul Robeson's son, who has filed a lawsuit against the government because now he finds out, or found out, that his father was a victim of the MKUltra program, mind control. MKUltra is a government program done in our name. Operation Northwoods, Operation Lantern Spike. I've taken a particular interest in April 4th. April 4th, where everybody is concentrating on the day that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was born, but the date that tells us about our government and who we are is April 4th, because that's the day he was murdered. And Operation Lantern Spike was the program that assigned 240 military intelligence personnel to track every aspect of what Dr. King did in March and April of 1968. And so for 2 months, 240 military personnel logged 16,900 hours. But they would have us believe that on April 4th, 1968, they don't know what happened to Dr. King. Or you can have Carnivore and Echelon and Magic Lantern, all done in secret. Or you can have National Security Council Memorandum Number 46, written by Zbigniew Brzezinski, that the subject matter is national security, making sure that Black Africa and Black America don't get together. This is a small little three-page document, but in the document, it talks about how they're going to make sure that stratifications and divisions exist within the African-American community so African-Americans won't bind together. It talks about how they're going to use the CIA and the FBI to further this little range of policy options that they have. And they say here in one little paragraph, which is very instrumental if you want to know how come you have so few people who can speak out. Paragraph H says, to support the nomination at federal and local levels of loyal Black public figures to elective office, to government agencies and the court. This would promote the achievement of a twofold purpose. First, it's easier to control the activity of loyal Black representatives within existing institutions. And then second, the idea of an independent Black political party would be doomed. It's all right here. It's from the U.S. government, the corruption costs. And then finally, we have the actual costs, the actual dollar costs of what this war is going to cost. And in my mind, seems to me that when you add up the corruption cost, the moral cost, the human cost, they far outweigh the dollar cost, and the dollar costs are astronomical. So I don't think we really have much choice now. We've got a government, a war hawk government of chicken hawks, a government that has installed itself on the backs of Black and Latino voters in one particular state, Florida. A company in Georgia was used to subvert the political process. And thank goodness for Greg Palast for rooting all of that out. And so we have no choice but to resist. And at this point, we have to remember the words of some of our real heroes. George Washington warned us about many things in his inaugural address in 1796. One of those things he warned us about was false patriots who wrap themselves in our flag, yet sell our values to the highest bidder. I think that's what we've got in Washington, D.C. right now. We have to remember Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy, refused to fight the Operation Northwoods war that the Pentagon wanted him to fight. But one of the things that I have learned in my investigations of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is that Bobby Kennedy had one wonderful, phenomenal idea in his mind, and that was naming Martin Luther King Jr. as his running mate. Can you imagine the America that we could have had with Bobby Kennedy and Martin King? That's what has been taken away from us by not doing enough at the very beginning We have allowed these people to steal the very idea of our republic from us, and we have no choice but to take it back. So, in my little, campaign for re-election, we had 47,000 Republicans. Well, what they did was they found a Republican, told her to run as a Democrat, gave her money, and then gave her their votes. And that's supposed to be legal, and it's supposed to be free and fair. The situation is in court now, and we will see if it's free and fair. And if it is free and fair, then I suspect that a whole lot more places that have the open primary, predominantly in the old Confederate states, we'll see a lot more of that activity to subvert even our ability, one party's ability to nominate within itself its own spokesperson. We'll see more of that happen. But the reception that I've had here really gives me the strength, the courage to fight on, because I know that we are the majority and they are the minority. Thank you very much.
Former Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at an event sponsored by Peace Action. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359 for a video or audio recording of today's show. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Johnny Sender, Yulin. Thank you very much to Orlando Richards and Simba Russo. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
One down.
Stay there. Give me the ball. Hey. Relax. All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascists. Throw some ground balls. It's more democratic.
What's this guy know anyway? If he's so great, how come he's been in the minors for 10 years? He's so hot, how come Annie wants me instead of him?
Oh, hey!
The Baseball Hall of Fame has canceled a commemoration of the classic film Bull Durham because one of its stars came out against the war in Iraq. Actually, two. The actor Tim Robbins joins us in our Firehouse studios.
Are there hidden messages in the film Bull Durham, or has the Baseball Hall of Fame gone off its John rocker?
We will first, though, go to Baghdad to speak with a reporter in the Palestine Hotel, which was raided yesterday by the U.S. Marines. And we'll talk to Asad Abdul-Khalil about the prospect of a civil war between Sunni and Shia Muslims. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least four more Iraqis have been shot dead in the center of the northern city of Mosul today. Al Jazeera's reporting some residents fired at people they thought were looting. The incident comes after U.S. troops fired on a crowd of civilians in Mosul yesterday. Al Jazeera reports the death toll from that shooting is now at 17. More than 100 people were injured. Eyewitnesses say the newly appointed governor of Mosul, Mashan al-Jabouri, was exhorting people to cooperate with the United States when chaos broke out. The crowd called him a liar and insisted he end his speech. When he continued, the angry crowd threw stones at him and ran towards him. That was when U.S. troops opened fire. Many among the wounded say the besieged governor asked U.S. troops to open fire. A U.S. military spokesman denied the charges, claiming U.S. troops were shot at from at least two gunmen on a rooftop and they fired back towards the rooftop. This comes as the U.S. held the first talks in Iraq on a post-invasion national government. The meeting was held at the Talil Air Base outside Nasiriyah. The U.S. said dozens of representatives from Iraq's ethnic, tribal, and exiled opposition groups were included, but they refused to release the names. Armed U.S. Marines stood behind barbed wire and blocked access to Iraqis who wanted to attend but were not invited by the United States. One Iraqi, Zamil Hamid, told London Guardian, quote, "I tried to participate, but they did not allow me to. One of the U.S. soldiers told me I was not on the list." The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the main Shiite Muslim group there, boycotted the talks, and thousands protested outside. The Washington Post reports protesters shouted, "No occupation." They denounced the gathering as illegitimate and unrepresentative of long-established Iraqi opposition groups. They said key Shiite groups and their leaders were not included in the meeting. The Guardian of London also reports protesters called for rule by their ayatollahs, not freedom as conceived by Westerners. Inside, The Guardian reports many of the speeches were met with lukewarm applause, and the most vital questions for the future remain unanswered. A statement at the end of the meeting set out 13 principles for a new Iraqi government, including democracy, federalism, nonviolence, and respect for diversity, including a role for women. It was unclear who'd suggested the points and whether the Iraqis had voted on any issue other than a decision to meet again in 10 days. For those outside, the Washington Post reports the meeting was upstaged by the arrival of Sheikh Mohammed Bakr Nasri in Nasiriyah. The 71-year-old Sheikh is a leader of the long-outlawed Dawah Party, a Shiite organization dedicated to forming an Islamic Republic in Iraq. He returned Monday after fleeing a death sentence in 1979. At the Al Bayt Mosque, he was greeted with cheers, poems, and crowds of more than 2,000. He delivered a fiery political speech calling on U.S. troops to make way for an Iraqi government within 6 months. U.S. forces captured Palestinian guerrilla leader Abu Abbas in Baghdad yesterday. Abbas masterminded the hijacking of the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro in 1985. One American was killed in that hijacking. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat is demanding his release. Erekat said a 1995 agreement between Israel and Palestine, signed by the U.S., states that members of the Palestine Liberation Organization must not be detained or tried for activities that occurred before the Oslo Peace Accord in 1993. Abu Abbas said he was abandoning terrorism after the Oslo Accords, and in 1998, the Israeli Supreme Court declared him immune from prosecution in Israel over the ship's hijacking. An Israeli security committee concluded he had renounced violence and allowed him to return to the Gaza Strip. Despite all this, Pentagon spokesperson Captain Frank Thorpe jumped on the capture of Abbas, calling it proof of a link between Saddam Hussein and terrorism. Reuters reports he also said it helped justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, the suspected chemical and biological laboratories found in trailers buried near Karbala are not smoking guns after all. U.S. nuclear experts said some radioactive material discovered there was most likely used for civilian purposes. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Tuesday U.S. forces are cutting off an oil pipeline that has been delivering oil from Iraq to Syria. The pipeline is capable of delivering 200,000 barrels of oil per day and is a huge source of revenue for Syria. Meanwhile, U.S. officials continued their accusations against Syria, claiming they believe former Iraqi spy chief Farouk Hijazi is one of several top-ranking Iraqis hiding there. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said yesterday there is no war plan, quote, right now. Meanwhile, Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa said the Australian government-owned special broadcasting service, he said this in an interview, Syria is willing to sign a treaty making the entire Middle East a zone free of weapons of mass destruction. But the Islamic Republic news agency is citing the German Daily Bild as reporting the U.S. has begun a major military buildup along the Iraqi-Syrian border. The German paper is reporting new U.S. troop contingents armed with tanks, fighter planes, and helicopters have been secretly deployed in the Iraqi town of Rutba. Amnesty International Tuesday charged U.S. forces are more concerned about Iraqi oil wells than the Iraqi people. Secretary General Irene Khan said, quote, there seems to have been more preparation to protect the oil wells than to protect hospitals, water systems, or civilians. Meanwhile, Ali Ismail Abbas has been airlifted to Kuwait for surgery. Ali lost both his arms in a U.S. bombing raid and became a symbol of civilian suffering in Iraq when his picture was broadcast around the world. Surgeons will attempt to give Ali prosthetic arms. But he leaves behind scores of wounded Iraqis at the mercy of the country's collapsing healthcare system. The BBC reports only four of Baghdad's 30 hospitals are still operating after power was cut to the city and U.S. troops failed to prevent massive looting. The Guardian's reporting tens of thousands of Iraqis have lost all of their savings as a result of the looting, which has left the country without a single functioning bank. Many government offices were stripped by ordinary people, but Baghdad's banks were looted by professional gangs. Millions more face the prospect of poverty and the absence of a government which can resume paying the salaries of teachers, doctors, civil servants, and factory workers. Meanwhile, the American dollar is taking over in many Iraqi cities. The Saddam dinar is fetching as much as $80 on the internet auction site eBay. And U.S. investigators are scrambling to track down Saddam Hussein's fortune. Middle Eastern banking sources told The Guardian as Baghdad fell, Iraqi bank accounts were ransacked and millions of dollars were transferred into private accounts abroad, going mainly through Europe to accounts in Jordanian and Palestinian banks. The missing money is estimated at $5 billion. A second Argentine journalist has died from injuries suffered in a car crash near Baghdad. Veronica Cabrera was 28 years old. She worked for the Argentine channel America TV. Now 13 journalists have been killed in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. A specially modified coalition plane called Commando Solo is flying over Iraq, broadcasting both television and radio several hours a day. The new network is called Towards Freedom. But with power cut in most of Baghdad, only people who have power generators can tune in, and the signal is weak. The new channel's broadcast included a commentary in which the presenter attacked Saddam Hussein, calling him uneducated and saying he'd seized power by force and had executed his own people. A news program called Iraq and the World claimed life in Baghdad is slowly getting back to normal as some shops are opening. British officials have said the content for the new service has been agreed in discussions with Iraqi exiles. Production of the British content has been outsourced to a private London-based company called World Television. They say its producers and journalists are all Arabs. The Pentagon is also producing content, including slides of propaganda leaflets. The Center on Conscience and War reports that at least several hundred U.S. soldiers have applied for conscientious objector status since January, when the prospect of war in Iraq seemed imminent. A Bush administration official is heading to Beijing next week for talks with North Korea. The breakthrough came after North Korea dropped its insistence on one-on-one talks with the U.S. China will play host and participate in the negotiations. The U.S. and North Korea have not held official talks since Pyongyang restarted its nuclear program and expelled international inspectors. And South African President Thabo Mbeki pledged today to pay reparations to nearly 20,000 victims of apartheid crimes. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has heard thousands of accounts of mutilation, rape, and murder since it was established. The family of each victim will receive a one-time payment of $4,000. Mbeki said his government will not seek compensation from businesses that profited from apartheid. In addition, he criticized lawsuits in the United States seeking apartheid damages from corporations like Anglo American, the world's largest precious metals company, and De Beers, the largest diamond producer. You are listening to Democracy Now! That's the late Edwin Starr, War, here on the War and Peace Report. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Tim Robbins live here in our Firehouse studio. But first, we go to Baghdad. U.S. Marines raided the Palestine Hotel yesterday morning. That's where foreign journalists are staying, and it's also where the U.S. has set up temporary operations. Marines kicked down doors, rousing journalists from their beds, pointing M16s in their faces, according to the Associated Press. Marines were seen guarding suspects in a hall and interrogating a man who said he was a cameraman. Marines press officer Sergeant Jose Guillen said Marines were checking the hotel to ensure it was, quote, 100% safe. Yesterday, I talked to Ezzedine Said, a reporter with Agence France-Presse based at the Palestine Hotel. I just asked him to lay out what had happened earlier in the morning.
A French journalist, for instance, his name is Jean-Paul Marie, he works for the French weekly Le Nouvel Observateur, said that three members of the Marines entered into his room and ordered him at gunpoint to lie on the floor. And according to him, the Marines were in full body armor and wearing balaclavas, checked his press accreditation papers, and then they searched his room. He said the whole thing lasted 10 minutes, and then... Soon after they left, another Marine entered the room and apologized, but then more troops arrived and searched his room a second time.
Can you tell us about the protest outside? We have read that the military tried to keep the reporters away from the protest.
Yeah, actually, today for the second or third day... Consecutively, dozens of Iraqis have been protesting at the Fardaus Square, just in front of the hotel, of the Palestine hotels, where all the journalists are staying. They were protesting. Apparently, they are becoming impatient with the lack of security in Baghdad and the lootings that are still continuing. So they have been protesting, and today the Marines who are guarding the hotel, and they have the refer and. Where they have set an operations center, are getting edgy, and they're preventing the journalists from covering the protests and keeping them like 30 meters away from the place where I think the protests were taking place. And apparently, the Marines have tips about a planned attack on the hotel, and this is why they were reinforcing the security measures in and around the hotel.
Can you describe what's happening in other parts of Baghdad, what you have been reporting on?
In other parts of Baghdad, actually nothing much is happening yet. The main events are taking place now in front of the hotel, of the Palestine Hotel. People are coming every day to protest because, you know, they're asking for they want electricity back, they want water back, they want protection for the hospitals, for the public administration. They want the U.S. military to stop the lootings which have been taking place since the U.S. military entered into Baghdad on Wednesday. And they want public servants, they want administrations to start working again so they can have a job once again. And one of the demands which the people who come to protest down at the Fardell Square are repeating all the time is that they do not want to see the U.S. military presence lasting forever in Iraq. They want them out once they've done their job.
Do you feel things are getting more or less tense in Baghdad?
Yeah, I think that's for the very first day when the American army entered into Baghdad. They were triumphant. They were received in they got a triumphant reception here in Baghdad by the local by the population. And the next day it was the people were still celebrating, but then they started protesting actually because they want to go on with their daily life. They want electricity, water. They want to open their shops again. They want to be getting their living again.
Have you had any trouble getting around?
No, it has been circulating in Baghdad for the last few days has become increasingly easier to get around in Baghdad to circulate. But the main problem actually is just getting back to the Palestine Hotel because the U.S. Marines has established very strict checkpoints at the entry of the hotel, and the long queues are building just in front of the hotel, and there's a body check, and sometimes the Marines get edgy if they find anybody who looks suspicious or who has a threatening attitude. But as far as circulating in Baghdad is concerned, circulation is resuming by the day, and we've been actually able to go to many places without any problems.
So the Marines are using the Palestine Hotel as a base of operations now?
Actually, they have set here some kind of an operation center where they have been receiving for the last 2 days Iraqi public servants who wish to resume work. Like, if they started with the police, and the next day they started getting the guys from the public servants from the electricity board, and today they had a meeting with the media people, the Iraqi TV station journalists and technicians who wish to resume work.
And that was Ezzedine Saeed of Agence France-Presse speaking to us from the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, actor and activist Tim Robbins on why the movie Bull Durham will not be celebrated at the Cooperstown Hall of Fame as planned in 2 weeks for its 15th anniversary. What does it have to do with the invasion of Iraq? Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we, well, take a listen. Maybe this is a film that is familiar to you.
Stay there. Give me the ball. Hey. Relax. All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist. Throw some ground ball. It's more democratic.
What's this guy know anyway? If he's so great, how come he's been in the minors for 10 years? If he's so hot, how come Annie wants me instead of him?
Oh, hey. And another thing, me. You don't know shit. All right? You want to make it to the show, you'll listen to me. Annie only wants you because she can boss you around. Got it? So relax. Let's have some fun out here.
Well, that is an excerpt of Bull Durham. Bull Durham, Jacob's Ladder, Bob Roberts' Shortcuts, The Hudsucker Proxy, The Shawshank Redemption, Dead Man Walking, Cradle Will Rock. These are just some of the films that have made Tim Robbins one of the biggest stars in Hollywood over the last decade. But it hasn't been his acting. It's his activism that's put him back into the headlines recently. Later this month, the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, was supposed to celebrate the 15th anniversary of Bull Durham. The film, which starred Tim Robbins and his future partner, Susan Sarandon, chronicled life in the minor leagues. It's since become a baseball classic. But the celebration in Cooperstown has been called off. Last week, Dale Petrofsky, the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame, announced the decision. Petrofsky, who served as an assistant press secretary in the Reagan White House, wrote to Robbins, quote, "In a free country such as ours, every American has the right to his or her own opinions and to express them. Public figures such as you have platforms much larger than the average Americans, which provides you an extraordinary opportunity to have your views heard and an equally large obligation to act and speak responsibly." Petrofsky went on to write, quote, "We believe your very public criticism of President Bush at this important and sensitive time in our nation's history helps undermine the U.S. position, which ultimately could put our troops in even more danger. As an institution, we stand behind our president and our troops in this conflict. As a result, we have decided to cancel the April 26th, 27th programs in Cooperstown commemorating the 15th anniversary of Bull Durham." Tim Robbins joins us in our studio to respond. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. Well, yesterday you gave a talk at the National Press Club. Reporters questioned you. What's your response to Dale Petrofsky?
Well, I think what was intended by this, in that I received the letter about the same time that he was sending it out, his letter, out on the Associated Press wire. I don't believe that he thought I was going to respond to it, and he certainly didn't give me much time. Indeed, it was about an hour after I found out that he had sent it out as a news story that I had to figure out some kind of response to it. For me, it was another example of an attack and intimidation that's been pretty common in the country on talk radio and with Clear Channel, with the Dixie Chicks. And I think that there's friends of this administration that are very proactive in the way they deal with protesters, with people that disagree with this president. They go on the attack. They go on it in a very aggressive way and a very clever way, using as many media sources as they can. And they send out very clear message to the rest of us that don't have mics in this country that oppose this president. And that message is, if you do not like what this president is doing, you better keep your mouth shut or there can and will be ramifications. And that's clearly what this letter was intended to do. Problem is, this AP reporter wound up finding me to get a response. And then after the AP story came out, sports writers all across the country went ballistic about this and became our first line of defense as far as the First Amendment goes. I'm really, really impressed and moved by what the sports writers have done throughout the country, and pretty much unanimously decrying this attempted intimidation of the First Amendment.
the last line of your letter to Dale Petrofsky that you wrote. Long live democracy, free speech, and the 69 Mets, all improbable, glorious miracles that I have always believed in.
That's right. I was actually there in the stadium, in the back row of Shea Stadium with my grandmother on October 16th, 1969, and I saw the New York Mets win the World Series after having been a fan for my young childhood. On my 11th birthday, I saw them win it all. So I do believe in miracles.
When you responded, what was Dale Petrofsky's response? I mean, he's not only the President Baseball Hall of Fame, President of the Baseball Hall of Fame, also former Assistant Press Secretary in the Reagan White House. And overall, not just his response, but has everyone at the Baseball Hall of Fame backed him up?
That's hard to say. I think they've been pretty silent on it. I think he did one interview where he kind of backpedaled a little. He didn't apologize or retract his statement, really. But what he did say was that he should have written the letter differently. I think he realizes he blundered and that he probably wore his beliefs too much on his sleeve and should have been more evasive in the way he did it. Unfortunately, that's still doesn't acknowledge the fact that what he has done is really politicized baseball and tried to send a message out that it's a Republican sport, and I can guarantee him it certainly is not. And since then, Roger Kahn has canceled he's a great baseball writer, wrote Boys of Summer, he's got a new book coming out, and he has canceled his appearance at the Hall of Fame in protest. And apparently they've been receiving thousands and thousands of emails at Cooperstown, and it's turned into a huge deal. I certainly didn't intend this. I mean, I just wanted to go up to Cooperstown, which I, by the way, really love, the town, and I think I would hate for this to hurt the town because there's a lot of decent people up there that are trying to make a living, and the Cooperstown Hall of Fame is a great museum, and it's a much larger thing than this guy, Dale Petrofsky. So I wouldn't recommend a boycott of this because there are people that would suffer that are trying to run shops up there and hotels and inns up there, and it's a really beautiful town and a great museum. If you have a problem with this guy, go ahead and give him a shout, though.
The Times says, Dale Petrofsky says, in hindsight, he would have handled it differently.
Yeah, I think that because most everyone is now calling for his resignation, and I think he's politically backtracking. He's learned his lessons well in the Reagan White House. By the way, he also complained that, why are they making such a big deal about me doing 2 years? But since then, he has worked for three Republican politicians, including Elizabeth Dole. And last year, he had Ari Fleischer up to the Hall of Fame. And he had, in this interview he did, he was also complaining about the fact that he would not promote politicization of anything in Hall of Fame, pro or anti-war. Yet last year he had Ari Fleischer up to talk about the war and the administration and politics. So he's fine with the right wing, but doesn't want to have anything to do with even a Democrat.
Well, he says now perhaps he would have considered upon reflection calling you up and calling you and Susan Sarandon up and asking for an assurance that you would keep politics out of the event, out of the 15th anniversary of Bull Durham. What would you have said?
Well, first of all, I certainly had no intention. I just loved the movie. I wanted to go see Ron Shelton and Robert Wool, who were also going to come up to Cooperstown. I had no intention of making a speech or anything ridiculous like that regarding at Cooperstown and the Baseball of Fame. It's just not the place, you know. I can separate the two. I am not a political animal. But if he asked me to give him a guarantee and some journalist came up to me, I would have to tell him, quite frankly, if some journalist came up to me and wanted to talk about the war, I would say what my opinion is. I'm not going to sit on my hands and say, oh, I can't speak because I'm in Cooperstown. It's ridiculous. I had no intention of making a speech. I don't even think there was a forum at which we could speak. But I think he, in his fervor and in his imagination, dreamed up some kind of political action that we were going to do, which is ludicrous.
I was just looking at Cradle Will Rock, the movie you did, but then the book, the movie and the moment. in it, in your introduction, you say, in the entire pantheon of films depicting that war, talking about World War II, I don't believe we've ever been given an indication of the American business and government complicity in the rise of the European war machines. This is many years later. Maybe you could talk for a minute about Cradle Will Rock, which had to do with McCarthyism, had to do with support for the arts, and compare it to what we're going through now.
Well, wars just don't just happen. There's planning that happens first. And I think in this book and in the movie, I tried to introduce a concept that's not very often seen, which is that at first we thought that Hitler and Mussolini were a great idea because they were fervently anti-communist. And if you consider that revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, happened in 1917, communism was very early movement at this point and very feared by people in America, powers that be. So at first, when Hitler and Mussolini started cracking down on communists in their own government, I think a lot of our business leaders and certainly a lot of our politicians, if not doing direct business with those two, certainly looked the other way and said, hey, you know what, taking care of the communists over there, that's fine with me. And I think that's a concept that was has never really been dealt with in films, and it's our complicity with the rise of fascism in Europe. Unfortunately, that pattern continues. You know, I don't think there's one war we've been engaged in the last 40 years where we haven't had something to do, business-wise or politically, with the person we were fighting previous to when we decided to engage in war with them.
You have done many movies, among them Bob Roberts. What about Bob Roberts relating to today? And just tell us the story of Bob Roberts.
Well, I'm actually going to be doing a screening of it, I think, in a month or so here in New York at the Museum of Television Broadcasting. I saw it recently, and it still works. It's really about a right-wing folk singing politician who is running for the Senate, and the backdrop happens to be the 1991 Gulf War. So there's an awful lot of stuff on the television in the background that's kind of relevant to what's going on now. History repeating itself, whatever. It's for me, he is the example of what happens when a certain political faction tries to appropriate some of our better progressive songs and art on the left. He basically takes the model of a folk musician, a protest singer, and turns it on its ear. Becomes a right-wing folk protest singer.
Now, that took place in more than a decade ago. What are your thoughts about any comparisons with what is happening now?
I think it's, unfortunately, it's why they call it a struggle. It is a constant fight, and history does repeat itself. I was did a reading the other day of Dalton Trumbo's letters, and his son Christopher came up to me and was talking about how he believes what's happening now is a mirror reflection of what happened to his father being blacklisted in the 50s.
What are your thoughts today about everyone right now in Hollywood? It's certainly not just you and Susan Sarandon. A lot of people under pressure. Sean Penn went to Iraq, said he lost a movie role as a result of it, a lucrative movie role. Do you feel that you have?
You know, it's very hard to tell. I think Sean is a different case, though. I think he actually has proof of it. But it's very hard to tell what the decision makers are making their decisions and what they're basing it on. And I think it's dangerous to get into a kind of a paranoiac thinking that you're going to limit the kinds of parts you get if you talk out. I think that's, it's first of all, crippling to you as a person because it might prevent you from saying something that you should be saying as a human being. But beyond that, there's also many, many other reasons why people don't get parts. You know, whether you're too tall, whether you're the wrong hair color, the chemistry's wrong with your potential co-star, there's many reasons. So to bring politics into that, I think, is just a waste of time, really. I believe that I will keep working. I believe there's enough people out in Hollywood that will employ me, and I'm not afraid of that. And if I was afraid, I wouldn't... It shouldn't be a matter of free speech. It shouldn't be a matter of intimidation. And there are a lot of people in Hollywood that are intimidated. And by the way, when we talk about Hollywood, if you talk about the real power hitters and the cover of the magazine kind of stars, they've been completely silent on this war. So to characterize Hollywood being against the war, it's kind of an erroneous assumption. It's many things, Hollywood. It's many different factions, just like America's many different kinds of people. There's people in Hollywood that have been responsible for the portrayal of Arabs in movies as evil and as terrorists. So there's a right-wing element in Hollywood as well. And so we shouldn't assume that Hollywood thinks one way.
Do you think Bull Durham has some messages in it?
Yeah, I think it has a message about love and baseball. And I think it's wonderful... It's a great line by Whitman that's quoted about baseball having a healing effect. And the saddest thing about this is that, you know, sports, I know people have different thoughts about sports. I love sports. I feel it's one way that we can go into a commonality without politics being involved. I can go to the ballpark and sit next to a guy who I'd never agree with in a million years and have a commonality with him, a common cause. However... for however brief a moment, I think those things are important. That to find the things that we can get beyond our disagreements about social issues and politics, and find ways to see each other as human beings. That's absolutely essential, and it's what the talk radio and the 19th century Fox Network, as Gore Vidal calls it, are really bent on. Driving a wedge into us, into dividing us, into making sure that certain people hate other people. The invective is so strong and so nasty. In fact, I heard someone told me that they were listening to the radio down south recently, and a talk radio person that's syndicated throughout the country actually went on the radio and said that he believes that a certain famous anti-war protester should be murdered. Now, this is crazy stuff, and it's happening all across America. And now I have a forum. I can go on NBC. I can come on Democracy Now. I can complain about this guy, Dale Petrosky. But there are millions and millions of people out in the United States right now living in a fear and being intimidated, this kind of mute opposition is kind of paralyzing. And what's important is that we get out parallel messages that say it's okay to speak out. It's absolutely essential for you to speak out. And even though it is dangerous in your community, you're not going to know you have allies until you do speak out. And so for the people that are living in this mute opposition and this kind of terrible loneliness that comes with that, to try to find avenues that you can create a common experience with people at this crucial juncture, to find where your allies are and even have the courage to find out who your quote-unquote enemies are and find a way to reach some common ground with them. It's crazy that we're dividing ourselves the way we are. It's absolutely nuts.
It's interesting. Yesterday on Fox, they were slamming you up and down all day on O'Reilly Factor.
I'm honored.
I think he said there are not two more exploitive people than Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon. The other person said, what do you mean by exploitative? He said they use every vehicle they can to get their word out.
Including our little wagon vehicle that we pull.
But you took on Fox in your National Press Club speech.
I did, yeah. And it's what I was just saying. I just think it's so irresponsible to be just... what are they trying to inspire for us to hate each other as Americans? For people to hate people that are against the war. Not to respect them and differ and have a healthy argument about them, but to hate and to murder. And it's absolutely nuts. And if they can't see the connection, by the way, between hatred and violence, they are they're living in a fantasy world. There's a lot of very frustrated people out there that all they need is a little pushing of the hatred button, and that can lead to their own violence, taking their own, you know, hand and creating their own justice in their own way. We have to find a healthier way. And if you're talking about that network, that network has about as much respect for the right to dissent as, well, you fill in the blank.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I wanted to end on the issue of the Oscars. Susan Sarandon went up and she gave the peace sign, mm-hmm. but she didn't refer to the war. Michael Moore did it in depth when he won for the best documentary for Columbine, talking about living at a time when we have a man who sent us to war for fictitious reasons and talking about the fictitious election. Everyone chose their own way. In the past, when you went up in the Oscars, you and Susan did make a statement. What was that one about?
Well, we've done that and we've not done that. We've also just presented at times. That one time that we did do it, it was a situation that was a pretty dire situation. It was this internment camp that had been set up in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. 180-odd Haitians had tested positive to HIV, and that's why they were being kept in this internment camp, basically a jail. And they was coming up on 8 months that they had been in there, and Clinton, during the campaign, had promised to close it down, and now it's March, and it's still in operation. Now, Susan and I had gone to different media outlets to try to get the message across, and no one was interested in the story. No one would talk to us. Susan got arrested. It was barely covered. There was an attempt made to try to get this message out, and it was falling on mute ears. So we used the opportunity, 26 seconds at the Oscars, in spirit with the red ribbons that everyone was wearing at the time, which was basically for awareness about AIDS. We brought up this issue about these people that were interned and basically dying in a jail in Guantanamo Bay. And because we did it, a week later it was closed down. But the fury of people at the, you know, how dare they? I mean, that was had ramifications for years for us. We were banned for a couple of years, and the only reason we got back to the Oscars is because we were nominated for Dead Man Walking.
Hmm. Is it true this year you drove to the Oscars in a fuel-efficient
yes.
limo?
Yes, we did.
So what does oil have to do with
it? It's not a limo, it's just a regular car. Yeah.
Excuse me. What does oil have to do with it all? And what do you think at this point, right now, at the with the networks like Fox and the others claiming almost total victory for the United States and saying that right now the left has nothing to say, and it proves they never did.
I had this to say. How about supporting the Troops for Life? How about the fact that right the same day that the United States Congress approved a measure that basically said we support the troops, the same day they approved a budget that cut $488 million out of, possibly more, I'm not sure on that figure, but it was a ton of money, out of the federal benefits programs for veterans. I mean, healthcare benefits. This is an administration that wants you to conceptually support the troops, but not actually with your dollars. They want to take your dollars and put them somewhere else. And I think it's $844 million. I think that's per year. And $25 billion, by the way, over 10 years, they're cutting out of health care benefits. Now, where does that go? You think about, you know, the cost of war and what happens when someone comes home. How about those poor kids that are in this terrible situation. They've got guns in their hands. There's panic. There's a moment of terror. And they react in the only human way that they can, which is to respond and make a mistake and kill an innocent person. I was reading about this in the Times a couple of weeks ago, and this poor kid was quoted as saying, "My life will never be the same. That changes my life forever." Now this kid's got to come home and deal with it. And where's the healthcare going to be for him? Are we going to really pursue this? Are we going to really support him when he comes home? Are we really going to provide him the proper kind of counseling and therapy that he needs to get through this? Or are we just going to leave him and say, "You know what? Suck it up, man. Be a tough one. You don't need care." And that's apparently this kind of the way it's being set, the policies being set by people that have actually never been in battle. These are people that really love war, but when they had the opportunity to do it themselves, to enlist, to go serve their country in Vietnam, they chose not to. They stayed stateside in cushy jobs. So I don't buy the hypocrisy of that. I'm all for getting those kids home and getting them healthy again and getting them into a situation where they could find a decent job. But the conceptual thing of support the troops, I don't buy it. I think it's filled with hypocrisy, and I think that we should really reinstate the money for the veterans' health care benefits.
What are you working on now, Tim Robbins?
I was working on a script till all this started to happen, and then I've realized I've had to be kind of be writing and doing interviews to defend myself, but I think I'm going to go back to writing my script when it calms down a little bit.
Well, I thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Tim Robbins, actor, activist. Here at Democracy Now!, you're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines, picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh, 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 ooh. Ooh.
What's going on? Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, some 20,000 people, mostly Shia Muslims, converged on Nasiriyah to protest the first talks in Iraq on a post-invasion government. Iraq's main Shia Muslim opposition group, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, organized the protest against control of the talks. The BBC reported that the Shia are concerned Washington's preparing to install a pro-U.S. puppet government. The Shia leadership in Najaf distributed instructions to mosques across the country to form defense committees and control what's happening in the streets. Prior to the invasion, rhetoric within the Pentagon and State Department pinned Shia Muslims, who were brutally suppressed by Saddam's Sunni Muslim minority, as reliable allies in the campaign. But during the invasion, U.S. forces met with heavy military resistance in Shia-dominated cities in southern Iraq. And now Shia Muslims are strongly resisting U.S. influence in reshaping the country. As U.S. occupation forces turn a blind eye to unrelenting violence and looting in cities throughout Iraq, friction between Sunni and Shia Muslims continues to escalate. The prospect of a civil war between Sunni and Shia Muslims threatens further instability in a country now plagued by lawlessness. We're joined right now by Asad Abu Khalil, who is a professor of political science at the University of California, an adjunct professor at UC Berkeley, and author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. Professor Asad Abu Khalil, you were born a Shia Muslim. You're an atheist now. Can you talk about the politics of the Shia in the South and what this 20,000 rally in Nasiriyah meant yesterday?
Well, I mean, I would, but it's important to note that the opposition to the United States military occupation of Iraq and the brutalization of the country by American war machine extends far beyond the Shiite community. In fact, the most vociferous voices of opposition to the United States in the last 2 days have been coming also from the city of Mosul. And in fact, yesterday, I mean, the story that is not being reported is this. Democracy is coming to Iraq and has come. However, it is being met with American gunfire. Yesterday, the people of Mosul demonstrated because the United States brought one of those corrupt figures from the Iraqi National Congress, imposed him to be a governor of that region, and the people are absolutely resolved to reject these kind of corrupt puppets. And some of these people that the United States is bringing were in the past henchmen of Saddam Hussein's regime. In fact, America's favorite Iraqi at this point, somebody who was sitting in house arrest in Denmark until recently, is a war criminal wanted by the Danish government for war crimes. He was whisked out of Denmark into Kuwait, and he is now with American troops in Iraq. So yesterday, the United States shot at the demonstrators in Mosul. They killed 10 and injured scores of them. And now you can see that on Arabic TV. Before I talked to you, I did see that. You won't see it on American TV. There was another demonstration in Mosul, and of course they shot at them again. On the Shiite ground, it is absolutely true. People in the past used to wonder in the United States, we don't really know what Shiites under Saddam think. And the people of the corrupt Iraqi National Congress used to say that by way of implying that once we go there, we know that they are all American flag-waving crowds. Well, now we entered, we know what their politics is. We basically realize that among the Shiites of the South, there's a very strong, well-organized Shiite fundamentalist organization. And, you know, there are people who are cynics like me who've always knew all along that the United States would never, ever allow democracy to spread into Iraq. So the question is we ask, I mean, yesterday many of these commentators were bringing up that the United States will never allow Shiite fundamentalists to come to power fair and square, just as they supported America did in 1992, the Algerian dictatorship, when it canceled the results of election because they brought in Islamic fundamentalists. So in other words, the intention of the United States are being revealed very clearly to the Iraqis, and the slogans that are being raised are continuously on a daily basis, no Saddam and no United States. I mean, they are being equated, and there was a banner yesterday in one demonstration, which is now increasingly being seen, which is Bush equals Saddam. And there was a big banner in Baghdad 3 days ago. It was all over Arabic newspapers. I didn't see it in one American newspaper, which read, Bush supports looters. So the grounds of opposition to the United States, unlike what the New York Times is implying today in the first cover story, is not only water, electricity, and all that stuff, which has been damaged by U.S. bombing, but also their own dignity, freedom. I mean, the real dignity and freedom, not the kind of freedom that the United States wants basically to install its own puppet government against the will of the Iraqi people.
We're talking to Professor Asad Abu Khalil. The politics, though, in general, between the Sunni and the Shia and the history of the difference.
Well, here, I mean, these are originally, this started as a political distinction back in the middle of the 7th century, and it evolved into political religio distinctions between both communities. And certainly the Iraqi government of Saddam Hussein played into these differences, and the Shiites were oppressed for decades. Any manifestation of their organizations were met with brutality by the regime, and their most important religious figures were executed. The most gruesome one was in 1980, the person who is one of the founders of Ad-Dawah party. We're going to hear a lot about this party. It looks like the most important political party in Iraq. It's a Shiite fundamentalist party with Iranian inclination. So basically, for those who cheered about the liberation of Iraq, get ready. The rule of the Ayatollah is coming to Iraq by virtue of the U.S. occupation and the military adventure inside that country. We're going to see that this place is going to get messier and messier. Sunni and Shiite differences, as I said, will be more pronounced, and perhaps also due to the United States manipulation of this. In preparation for this Iraqi war, the United States played the most gruesome sectarian game, splitting Sunnis, Shiites, and dealing with them. They basically calculated the Shiites are going to be more submissive, so they focused entirely on the Shiites, and the Sunnis were very much ignored. They said, we don't need the Sunnis. These differences that were exacerbated by the United States are going to erupt out in the open. There are some Iraqi secularists, especially, who are very worried about these consequences, but perhaps it's going to be too late, because America's heavy-handed rule, and especially by bringing these corrupt Iraqi National Congress people, the ones who have struggled against Saddam's regime so bravely in the last so many years in the casinos, Brussels, and nightclubs of London, are being brought into the country to rule it and speak on the, in the name of the Iraqi people.
Professor,
that's not going to fly.
Professor Abu Khalil, this latest news, Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri of Lebanon and his cabinet resigned following months of divisions, and the significance of that. We only have 30 seconds.
It's not as significant as press reports are indicating. This has already been pre-cooked in advance. The formation of the new cabinet has already been prepared. The Lebanese newspapers for today have printed the names of them. It's not as important. It's just the formation, changed of names by the same old faces and in coordination with Syria.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Professor Asad Abu Khalil, Professor of Political Science, University of California, adjunct professor at UC Berkeley, author of Bin Laden Islam and America's New War on Terrorism. We will be back with you soon. But that ends today's show. If you'd like to get a copy of the program, call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by the greatest, Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Khudus, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. Thanks also to Uri, Angela, John, and Yulin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Talk to me so you can see.